Good afternoon, and welcome to High Notes in week six of our 2019 season. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and I'm joined today by the Escher String Quartet, which is a great pleasure. The Escher Quartet has been in existence for about 15 years.
Yeah, it will be 15 years next January, so almost.
Fantastic. And we are proud in Aspen that they have an affiliation with us. The personnel, first to my left, is Adam Barnett-Hart. Then this summer, they're touring with a different second violin, and so we're happy to welcome to Aspen Brendan Speltz, Pierre Lapointe on viola, and Brooke Speltz on cello. You might notice that Brooke and Brendan have the same last name, and this is because they are brothers.
As far as we know.
Yes. The Escher have won many, many awards. I'm just going to mention a few things. One is that they received the Avery Fisher Career Grant. This is somewhat unusual, an honor for a string quartet. But you may also have noticed this summer that the people I've interviewed, virtually all of them, have won the Avery Fisher Career Grant. Does this mean that it's just given out willy-nilly to almost every person? Or does it mean that we have chosen a truly extraordinary group of young artists this summer? It is the latter, and I am honored to be a nominator for the Avery Fisher Career Grant and Avery Fisher Prize, and so I am well aware of who has won it or not won it.
Well, if you're thinking about the prize, we would be.
Yeah, that comes along, doesn't it? The Escher Quartet also had important mentorship from the Emerson String Quartet. The Emersons are here in Aspen. They will be playing tomorrow evening. Do not ask me for tickets to that concert. Thank you. I thought you might just tell us some about how you chose the name Escher Quartet.
Oh, sure.
I guess I'm the only one who's been talking, but I will explain, since it was pretty much my idea originally. So Pierre and I are the two members that are still left that founded the quartet, and we started at Manhattan School of Music, and basically I think the only reason that we became a quartet was that our first coach was David Sawyer, who was the cellist of the Guarneri Quartet for a very, very long time. And he was just such an extraordinary person and influence on us. And he really motivated us to work very hard and to start the quartet right out of school. And I believe we actually might have come up with the name here.
Yes.
I actually am pretty sure we did. So that's a nice little connection. We had just sort of played about a year at school, and we still didn't really have a name. Or maybe we already had one, did we?
No, it was a year and a half.
We played about a year and a half, and we were trying to figure out a name. And we were here, and we came up with a million names, and they were all terrible, as most names are, because it's very hard to just come up with something that actually makes sense. My father is a physicist, and he had given me this book when I was 13 or 14 called Gödel, Escher, Bach, which is a sort of pretty well-known book. I think it was written in the 80s. And the author tries to show connections between the works of the logician Gödel, the artist M.C. Escher, and Bach. And some of the things that he talks about are sort of, well, to start with the musical example, how Bach inverts things and flips them, especially in fugues, basically how he manipulates material. And then he draws connections to how Escher also does that in his artwork and shows paradox and all of these sort of interesting effects. Anyway, I just had happened to read this book, and so there was a musical connection in my mind of Escher and Bach, at least. And then we sort of thought, well, in a quartet, we all have our individual parts that we're playing, and everything combines to form something which is much more interesting than just those individual parts. And in the same way, Escher can often take very simplistic elements, for example, a bird, a very simple picture of a bird, and it's the way that he sort of manipulates that makes it much more interesting and combines it with other things. So that's sort of the justification that we came up with for why it made sense to name ourselves after that artist.
Yeah, I think it makes total sense. Now, we're going to have, I did not plan this, but we're going to have a little, like, Metropolitan Opera quiz thing, and I'm not going to put the ushers completely on the spot because anyone can shout out answers. But what string quartets are also named after artists?
The Miro.
Miro. Calder. That's a really good one still. No. There's a symphony named Jupiter. I think there's a Cassatt quartet, but I'm thinking of a more famous quartet and more famous artist. Okay, Vermeer.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
Okay. sorry about that. So the Ushers will be playing on Saturday night in Harris Hall at 8 p.m. And they have, to me, a particularly beautiful program and a program that's resonant with our season theme, but also resonant with just putting great music on the stage. And so the program will open with Mozart's F major quartet, which is Kerschel 590. And so I have some thoughts about this quartet, but I'd rather hear anything you have to say about the piece, history, how it feels to you.
Well, since we're talking about our inception, actually, if I remember correctly, it was one of the first quartet that we learned, the Adam and I with the other two members, the Mozart 590. And David Sawyer, I remember we went to his apartment and we practiced as much as we could because we were not a quartet beforehand. So it's a difficult thing to manufacture playing a quartet of that caliber in a week. And I remember vividly going there, play the first movement, and he goes, "Everything's out of tune and not together, do it again." And we were kind of, oh God, because we had put like our hearts out in that, you know, working out the little details of that piece. But, you know, we kept working at it. And I remember playing my first vivid experience of playing in the quartet because we made all those decisions about what to do in the Mozart, because there's very few markings, unlike, you know, like other composers like of the 20th century. He marks forte, piano, you know, he doesn't mark if you need a retard, but we had made all those decisions, and in rehearsals, everything worked out like quite good, but then you go on stage and it's a different animal completely, and I remember what is happening, like none of the discussions that we had made, like, happened. Was like, everyone was doing their own thing, and I was like, wow, this is very difficult. That's what and also that piece, to be fair, is extremely difficult, especially for the cello, because, you know, they're known as a set of three, the Prussian quartet, and there's a big cello part. He goes very high. But also in the last woman, there's a lot of little dwiddling you have to do with the left hand. If you come to the concert, you'll see it's not an easy thing to do, and it's always keeps us honest. Playing a quartet by Mozart.
Yeah, well, I would add, actually, you sort of touched on a feeling that I associate with Mozart more often now than I did when I was younger. When I was young, I was stupid. I didn't know any better. Now I'm a little older, a little wiser, and I think of Mozart as the great humiliator, because there's really nothing more difficult than playing Mozart well, because even in comparison to Beethoven or to Haydn, there's nowhere to hide. Yet the writing, especially in these late quartets, is incredibly technically difficult for all four instruments. And if even in fast passage work, if one note doesn't speak or if one note is not precisely where it needs to be, we can definitely hear it. And so you're constantly, this piece in particular, the 590, it is his final quartet. I'd say the quartet has probably performed it 35 to 40 times in the past year. And it sort of, in a way, ruins the 2 days leading up to every concert for me. because I'm somewhat overwhelmed by stress and the need to once again revisit this part, and whenever I think, you know what, I've played it enough, I'm going to focus on the Ives or something, and it gets to concert, and I'm humbled very quickly. So it's a wonderful challenge, and it's one of the great quartets of the literature, in particular the second movement, which you could identify as the slow movement. There's actually a bit of a discrepancy. Is it an allegretto or is it an andante? Two sources of very reputable interests, they differ on what it is. I think we sort of feel very much so that it's more on the andante side. We play it perhaps a little bit on the slower side, but it's one of the most heartfelt, beautiful movements. It was actually, I had four of my closest friends perform that movement at my wedding during the ceremony. It's a very, very special piece to me, and I think to all of us.
You know, with how difficult you guys described this piece, that was actually the first piece that I ever played with the Escher Quartet a month ago. So you can imagine how I felt going on stage. Performing that for the first. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, I don't feel too bad for you.
So you mentioned that it's one of three quartets that are nicknamed the Prussian Quartets. Why is that?
Well, actually throughout the past year, as I've done a little bit more research on the history of the piece, and in particular of these three final quartets, which are nicknamed the Prussian, we've always been told or led to believe that Mozart wrote these pieces for the King of Prussia, who was a very capable amateur cellist. And Mozart wrote of receiving a commission to write six quartets for this king. In the end, he only ended up writing three. Now, where the texts differ is whether or not the king was even aware that Mozart had written these pieces for him, or whether or not the king actually received the music, and furthermore, whether or not Mozart ever received any money from the king. So we're not entirely sure. In the end, what we do know, I believe, is that he ended up selling them rather cheaply to a publishing house because he was at the end of his life. He was sick. Constanza, his wife, was quite ill, and he was always in desperate need of money. So there's a sort of mixed historical reference to the piece.
So there's sort of a ghost in that story of the Brandenburg Concertos and the circumstance of them being written for someone who perhaps never noticed them or cared, and also Brandenburg and Potsdam, because Mozart was in a very unhappy moment in his life, so he has given you unhappiness, but he was feeling it himself, and he embarked on a series of trips around Europe trying to drum up business, and one was to Potsdam, which was the seat of the emperor.
Okay. No, one other thing I might just quickly add, because you mentioned that he was indeed in a very rough part of his life, and he was nearing the end of his life, and he was always ill, and he had exhausted all of his friendships because he kept borrowing money and not being able to repay. One thing as classical musicians that we oftentimes do is we try and draw comparisons and parallels to what was happening in the composer's life, to the music that he wrote. And what's so amazing about these quartets is that if you had not known that Mozart was in one of the most desperately ill and depressed part of his lives, you don't hear that in the music. There's absolutely no relation to that whatsoever. So oftentimes, it's not the best thing in the world to try and find historical context of when the piece was written and how it was written, and have that try to inform how to play it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these things do line up, but for Mozart, oftentimes does not.
Yeah. Well, it's the time when he wrote Così fan tutte, and which is sparkling and funny, and that's not exactly how he was feeling. He had already written his last symphonies, and then these, as you said, are his last quartets. Anything else about the late Mozart style? And what it requires of you.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about this, just the last quartet, which is actually different to me from the other two, is how pared down it is. It starts with an actual unison among all four instruments. It starts with a triad, ba-dee-deen, just an F major triad, and then a scale, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum. So it's basically it's just building blocks, the very basic building blocks of tonal musical language, and that's how he starts this last quartet that he wrote. And I mean, even if you look at the second movement, it starts with rhythmic unison. Bum, 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 bee, yum. And then again, dum, dun, dun, dun. So, and actually, it goes on for another six measures in rhythmic unison in the second movement. So in a certain sense, he's pared down to such a basic, simplistic thing, but there's so much depth in that. And I think that's what's really amazing about this last quartet. There's not a lot of counterpoint necessarily even. A lot of it is just, it's quite simple, but very deep. And I think that can be typical of a lot of composers' late style, is this sort of paring back. If you look at Beethoven's last quartet, he pares back from 131 and it goes to 135, which is a very classical sounding in many ways. And there's weird unisons in it that almost don't even make sense. And there's the same sense of unison writing and pulling back into a more classical style. And I think that's true even in this piece.
Lovely. So that is the opening work on the program. Then there's another work that we're going to talk about later. And then the second half is Schubert's G major quartet, given in the Deutsch catalog, the number 887. So tell us about Schubert and how it pairs with Mozart.
Well, this is a big piece. I'll start out by saying that. This is also his final string quartet, his final complete string quartet. And it's certainly on practically a Mahler-esque scale of not just length, but drama and physical exertion. It's one of the most tiring and one of the most exhausting pieces to play. But I, in many ways, it's one of the great journeys, not just as a performer, but as a listener, to just have this wash of sound for about, I'd say, a good 45 minutes, depending on how many of the repeats that you do. And he certainly, in the first movement in particular, there's one sort of secondary theme, this sort of lilting theme that he takes great pleasure in repeating over and over and over again, but it's always just slightly varied, first in which voice has the primary motive of that theme, and then in which key it's written in, and then the certain sort of counterpoint that takes place in the later variations where there's a separate line going on that's in addition to it. In a way, sort of similar to Brahms's idea of sort of varying thematic variation, in particular that first movement, it truly is a journey because this same thing keeps coming back, but in a slightly different fashion. Pierre, you could probably add something to that.
Yeah, since we're talking about technique here a little bit, you know, if we're talking about the quartets of Joseph Haydn, for instance, and Beethoven, because you want us to compare Schubert with Mozart, Haydn, oftentimes, because they kind of invented that concept, what we call now sonata form, that term did not exist back then. They just played, you know, they reinvented how to write music and what is what we call classical style now. And oftentimes Haydn had one idea, and he would exploit that to the utmost. And Beethoven studied with Haydn, and he did the same thing. But so that in that regard, they're very similar. Even in their last movement sometime, they're going to incorporate the concept of sonata form in the rondo form too, where they call that rondo sonata. But with Mozart and Schubert, it's a little bit different because they have so many ideas. They don't need to rely on one idea and just to recycle it as much as they can. And they had the gift of melody. And I think that's one thing you can definitely associate between the two, between Mozart and the Schubert. And like Brooke said, this is the last quartet that Mozart wrote, and it's also the last quartet that Schubert wrote. But Schubert really puts the proportion. I totally agree with Brooke. It's almost like a Mahler-like, or even Bruckner in a way. Like he paves the way for those composers, because we have so many tremolos, which recalls like a technique that often you find in orchestra music, when the tune is given to the winds or to the brass. And we do that quite a bit. And a funny anecdote here, when we had coachings with David Sawyer with that piece, Actually, it's one of the first pieces we played as well, that the Schubert G major. We performed that as our debut in Alice Tully Hall. And we were preparing for it, and we had a lesson in his apartment. And he said, you know, I remember hearing from the Budapest Quartet, whenever they played that piece in concert, the next day they would, you know, while they would be shaving, they would like cut themselves because of all the tremolos. Like, so it's just, but it is taxing. It's hard to play, and I don't know what the Schuppanzig Quartet would have made of that piece, because I remember they were asked to play the Rosamund, which they did, but then Det and the Maid they said that was too difficult. But I think the G major, it's another level. It's almost like an alien work, and I don't know what it would have said. I don't think they would have been able to comprehend that piece, because it's such on a different, it's cosmic almost, it's epic, you know, it's, it stands out from, I don't even know. Like, that guy knew he was dying. I don't even know how he could muster the energy to write something like that.
Yeah, I was going to add, just as a listener and as a musician, I think Schubert, especially in his late period, kind of enters into this, what I...
You mean when he was 30?
Yeah, it's 30, when he was younger than me. That's a sad thought. He sort of enters this, what I like personally refer to as a Mount Rushmore of sort of divine composition, which I attribute to Bach, Beethoven, especially in his late period, Schubert in his late period, you know, a few other composers, I think, sort of graze that special place, which I think happens when composers are towards the end of their life reflecting on things, even though Schubert might have only been 30, but going through a lot of struggle, and at the same time producing this incredible art. And there's a famous story about Schubert on his deathbed only wanting to hear Beethoven's last quartets, especially probably the most famous of his quartets, Opus 131. And in this piece, the Schubert piece we're going to be playing on Saturday night, in the slow movement, he actually references explicitly the very opening bar of 131. So interesting connections there.
Well, I just wanted to say one thing. I thought it was interesting that Pierre sort of grouped Haydn and Beethoven together and then Mozart and Schubert. And I think one thing that definitely groups those two pairings together, if you look at Beethoven manuscripts, they're just a disaster. And I think Haydn also was a great worker-outer of music. He would rewrite, and especially Beethoven. But if you look at Mozart and Schubert, they are just transcribers, basically. They pretty much transcribed the piece from start to finish. And I think one of the clues is when someone writes out an entire line and then starts on the next line. So, I mean, you know, as a composer, you probably don't write out one whole part and then start on the next part. That's a very strange concept. Normally you would write one part, then write the next, you know, you would write at least a few measures of each part probably, and then sort of figure that out. But Mozart would just write a whole part. If you look at the Requiem, that's the problem, is we have a whole line, but we have no idea what the context of that part was. And so someone had to finish it. But both Mozart and Schubert were just transcribing music that was in their head, and maybe just transcribing basically from God. It's pretty amazing.
Well, to be super clear, because I love that point, but it's that Mozart and Schubert would write, say, the whole first violin part out, and then say, oh, and the second violin is doing this that time. Oh, and the viola is doing this, whereas any normal composer thinks, in bar one, this happens, yeah, and then in bar two, this happens.
But they didn't have to think about it. That's what right. That's the point, is that they right. already knew the whole piece and all of the parts. So they could just transcribe one part at a time, and that was easier.
Right. Well, we had the Jupiter Symphony yesterday, and in the program notes was the comment that Mozart wrote that symphony almost faster than you could actually write it down.
Someone told me recently, they said, if you just tried to transcribe from Mozart scores, so if, in other words, just copy down every note that he wrote, it would take you almost the rest of your life to do that, because yes. he just wrote down so many notes.
Yes. Okay, a few more points of clarification or interest. You mentioned, Pierre, the Schuppanzig Quartet. This was the string quartet that also played Beethoven's works for him, and around the same time believed that Beethoven was playing a mean joke on them with the Grosse Fuge, that he didn't really mean for it to be played. So it's interesting that they were also involved with Schubert's works.
Well, actually, if I may just jump off that, just regarding the Schuppanzig Quartet, they are actually one of the most important ensembles in the history of classical music, Western art music, as, of course, they did premiere all of Beethoven's quartets. But in particular, the first violinist, Ignaz Schuppanzig, really was the creator of the modern-day chamber music concert, which up until that point was either played in the home or played in the courts and whatnot. But Schuppanzig, sort of near in the last 8 years of Schubert's life, decided to put on these concert events where you would have different composers' music at the same event, which was very rare at the time. And at the beginning, the first couple of events, Schubert, although he was actually somewhat nearing the end of his life, was really only known as a wonderful composer of song. And his instrumental music was not taken seriously and almost never performed. And Schuppanzig commissioned two quartets from Schubert for these events. The first one was the Rosamunde Quartet, which is one of the great quartets of literature, and the second one was the Death and the Maiden Quartet, which is another staple of the repertoire. And Pierre, you mentioned this before, the Rosamunde was received very well by the Schuppanzig Quartet. The Death and the Maiden, they read the first movement, and this is one of the most performed pieces of our time now. The Schuppanzig Quartet read the first movement and said, apparently the quote is, Ignaz said to Schubert, "Sonny, go back and stick with your songs." Of course, we have a completely different viewpoint of that now, but it was really these events that Schuppanzig put on that became the sort of first step towards modern-day chamber music concerts, where you had one ensemble perform works of a variety of composers.
Yeah, and we will next year, in the Beethoven year, be recreating a famous 1808 Academy concert of Beethoven's, in which was the old format, because it was a 4.5 hour long concert of only premieres of only Beethoven. Yeah. And in that concert, the 5th and 6th symphonies, the 4th piano concerto, the aria A Perfido, the Mass in C, the choral fantasy, and maybe something else.
We should do a 4.5 hour concert of premieres of one modern composer. See how
there
that
you
goes.
Are. There you are. We would love that. And it was in Vienna in December, and there was no heat in the auditorium. So stay tuned for that next year. Because Pierre mentioned Alice Tully Hall, I have to say I forgot in introducing them to say that they are affiliated also with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. And we're so close with David Finkel in Wuhan, I thought I would mention that project. And you have your work with them later this summer, I think.
No, we do actually. Yeah, we've already been, we've been with them at Menlo, and then we're also going to be at Saratoga Springs, where it's sort of through CMS, has a bit of a thing there.
Super. Now, you know, we're talking about the length of this Schubert piece. Schumann, writing about Schubert's work of this period, not this particular piece, said it has heavenly length. Are you taking some repeats, all repeats, no repeats?
Well, I don't know if you've made that. I believe the heavenly length term is for the C major symphony, which, with all of the repeats, can approach about an hour long. I don't know if we'll take the repeats. You'll just have to come and
should,
find
maybe
out.
Maybe we should take a survey.
The thing about, I don't know, my opinion is exposition repeats and first movements are oftentimes, they're sometimes just a disappointment, you know? I'm not sure that we'll do that one.
I think it depends if Brenda's going to shave the next day or not.
Yeah. I don't, it's already so much music, I think we might leave off that first movement repeat.
Okay.
Unless you're personally offended by that.
I wouldn't say offended, but my personal opinion is, yes, do the repeats. For this reason, and it will tie into a story about the C major quintet, one of my great teachers observed that when you take the repeat, you hear, you have modulated to the dominant, And you suddenly hear the opening in a completely different way because it follows the move to the dominant. And he said, this is not an accident and it's not a matter of indifference to the composer. However, one of my piano teachers said, having to do with the B-flat late sonata that I was studying at the time, and he said, if you play that repeat, I will shoot you.
And doesn't that sort of exemplify the difference between performers and sort of the other side, scholars or composers?
Yes.
Performers are always like, oh, please don't take the repeat.
Yes. Well, I'll stick with your point about sonata form, which I also really love. I love talking about that. What we now call sonata form, and you know, virtually all first movements of sonatas and symphonies by Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven are in this form or some version of it. But the term didn't exist, and none of those composers would have said, "And now for a sonata form, yay!" What they instead were after was a sense of drama and progression, particularly through keys rather than through ideas. And so that's what unites the form, but it's absolutely fascinating and true that Mozart was likely to write a contrasting second theme, and Haydn was very unlikely to. So that, I think you made that point, but I just...
Well, in this piece, this piece, the sonata form is a little strange in a certain sense because the first theme is ba ya ba bum. It's not really, it's not a normal kind of theme. It's almost more it's a very gestural theme and just very intense. And then the second theme just gets repeated in so many different contexts that it doesn't necessarily have the feeling of just contrast. It feels like that becomes sort of the world itself. And then it's just the way that it's colored every time. And so sonata form has so many different gradations of how composers use it to emotionally impact the music.
Yeah, it entirely depends on the material. You know, they're going to unfold the material the way it can be. Like, for instance, in that Schubert first movement, I think because he's so gifted with ideas, so he's also known for writing, like, you know, in something in major key and then going back to minor, he does that a lot. But that's obviously for dramatic reasons, and composers beforehand, like especially Haydn in the string quartet, for instance, he was not so much after that contrast per se. He would do it if the material was suited to that, but he would be, like more likely modulating to the dominant, but with Schubert, I think you get like a huge contrast, like by that like second theme, ta-ding, bom, 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 but it's played so many times. The first time I think is in the first violin, and then all of us like we're repeating it at that time, like, and with a little bit different variations. But you're gonna hear that. Oftentimes Schubert's, unlike the others, he repeats himself. That's why the question of if we're going to do the repeat or not is apropos.
Well, one interesting thing, too, about the sonata form in this first movement that I was just thinking about is the way that he brings the recapitulation back is very unusual, I think. So in the beginning, the way the quartet starts, it starts with a very soft chord in major, just a triad, and then there's a huge crescendo, and then there's a declamation of minor. So... bum, bum. That's the start. And then in the recap, it sort of flips everything. It doesn't flip everything, but it starts very quietly in minor, and then it doesn't crescendo, and there's a pitz chord in major. So it's this very interesting way of bringing bringing us back to the beginning, but in a completely transformed way.
So that opening is also a prefiguration, if you will, of the quintet in C opening. And I thought I would tell a quick story, if you don't mind, about the same professor that I mentioned who explained why you should take the repeat. He was fortunate to come from a very wealthy family, and he was fortunate to be an incredibly lovable person. His name was Edward Cohn. And when he died, he left the instructions that at his funeral there should be no speaking of any kind, no welcome, certainly no eulogy, and the entire service should be just the Schubert Quintet in C, played with all the repeats. And
he really had a thing about repeats.
Uh-huh. And he assigned me to be the person who arranged this. So we had the ceremony in the chapel of Princeton University, and 2,000 people attended this memorial. To be name-droppy, I was sitting with the president of Princeton and the president of Harvard at the time, both of whom had been very close friends of this guy. And so I got the Brentano Quartet to come down, and they played, of course, magnificently, and it took an hour. And then it was over. And the president of Harvard turned to me and said, "Can you explain to me why that just happened?" And I said, "I can, but I don't have time right now." And I wrote him about a 25-page letter explaining why to this person that was the one thing he wanted. Okay, that was just a random story.
Are you talking about Edward T. Cohn, the writer? Okay.
Yeah. So we now turn to the third work on the program, which comes, however, in the middle, and that's Charles Ives's second string quartet. And how do you place this into the program? You're thinking about the program.
I think that's a very difficult question, actually. I'm not exactly sure how it fits.
Contrast, no.
It definitely contrasts in some ways, but in another sense, maybe I think all three works have a very serious intent behind them. So maybe that's one connection that we can draw. I don't know, actually. That's kind of difficult to describe. I would say the Mozart and the Schubert both have a lot of very unified writing. There's a lot of unison, rhythmic unison at least, in both pieces. And in the Ives, it's completely the opposite, which is that we basically, well, not completely, there's moments of that, but a lot of times it's the opposite. So the Ives is a real exploration of what it means to be a string quartet in a certain sense. And that's what he was trying to explore with this piece. I mean, if you look at the movement titles, it's very clear. The first movement, discussions, second movement, arguments, and the third movement, which is where we all come together, Call of the Mountain, because it sort of negates the arguments, nature as this force. It means that anything that we could argue about is meaningless. So I think the third movement has a lot of rhythmic unisons sometimes, and that's just to show that the quartet has come together. But the other two movements, the second movement especially, we never play together. It's just this total cacophony of voices.
I think like there's a count of like Charles Ives saying like you went to hear the Canizo Quartet playing, let's say, Mozart, and he was unsatisfied. He said they're like too polite, and I have to be careful. I'm going to say this, but he called their style a little bit effeminate. I think that's what he says. And then he wanted to like bring some masculinity into the art form, and I think like that. And he that's why he designed. Actually, I believe that's his last quartet too. So it's all their last quartet. That could be a theme, like the program, if you wish. But in that quartet, like Adam mentioned, he's trying to portray. So there's like very few, but like some indications in the parts. Like he's trying to. Obviously, the second woman is called Arguments, but then there is even the name for the second violin. He calls him Rollo. And then you see that, like, and Rollo apparently is trying to make everyone agree, but it falls flat, and then we keep the argument. But
Since just to mention something, if you're looking for a unifying theme, all three of the pieces actually don't have that many markings. Schubert has some markings, but there's a lot that you have to sort of bring to the piece, the knowledge of style, and just it's so much repetition that you have to find things in the music. The Ives basically has no instruction, and I think it's sort of on purpose. He wanted this sense of spontaneity and vitality and question mark about how each performance would be different from another one. So I think that's a unifying theme. Sorry, go ahead though.
Well, it's sad for Brendan to be called Rollo, because Ives didn't use that name in a nice way generally in his writings. But I don't know if you play the Elliot Carter quartets.
We have not.
Okay. But Elliot Carter also felt, with a very different effect, but he felt that he wanted his quartets to be four very different characters, and he wanted to portray extremely different characters rather than have them come together and create one beautiful thing. But whether he knew it or not, Elliot Carter was borrowing this idea from Ives.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pierre touched on this. I mean, in many ways, this piece was a response to what he felt was the conservative aspect of chamber music, particularly in America. And he set out to write something offensive. That was actually his goal. And he inserts a fair amount, and by offensive, I mean raw on the ears and offensive to the listener, and something that can be incredibly difficult to decipher, and in many ways is not meant to be deciphered in the way that a late Beethoven string quartet is, for example. And he does insert a lot of writing into the score, a lot of words, where at one point you mentioned this character that he came up with, Rollo, who he assigns to the second violin and in the second movement, which is titled Arguments, where we are literally just screaming at each other with our instruments. There's a break, there's a pause, while the second violinist plays something very beautiful as meant to sort of pacify everyone, but it's not enough, and we end up going back to our argument. And there's one of my favorite markings at, there are two of my favorite markings in this movement. One is as we re-enter our argument, it's Allegro con fistosuato, I think. and then at the, that's the very end of the movement. The very end of the movement, the last two entrances are in quick succession. Two of us play a note, then the other two play a note, sort of a pa-pum, and he writes Allegro con fistosuato, and then in parentheses, knockout. So we've the argument has reached a point to where we've knocked each other out. But that being said, but regardless of all the humor that he puts in, it's one of his more serious works. And I think compositionally speaking, in comparison to the first quartet, where he almost entirely relies upon old American hymns and themes, the battle cry of the Republic, or old Lutheran hymns, or Marching Through Georgia, or all of this stuff, Dixie. And it's the first quartet is really quite friendly and very tonal. But in a way, it actually doesn't quite have the same depth as the second quartet does. And even in his drive to offend, there's actually an incredible amount of emotion in the piece that, for me in particular, it took a while. It took a while to reach that point with the piece. Once I did, I became utterly convinced by it. And as a matter of fact, as much as we've played both quartets, and we've played both quartets many times, we actually just recorded both quartets. The second quartet, there's a certain satisfaction musically that of some sort of journey.
I think, yes, especially when certain places in the third movement have just a lot of beauty, and they sort of stand out from this very difficult music that we're just sort of going at each other a lot of the time. And sometimes in the third movement, everything sort of drops away, and there's just these beautiful textures and beautiful harmonies and just, I think, very deep music that has a lot of meaning. It's sometimes hard to get to that, but I think as performers, we've played it, we've learned the piece well enough now that we understand that. And it's probably, I think it's a very difficult piece for audiences, to be honest.
Mm. Well, I wrote out a quote that Ives wrote about the piece. And he said, four men converse, discuss, argue in re politic, fight, shake hands, shut up, then walk up a mountainside to view the firmament. So that's going to be the lead-in to just a few minutes to talk about the life of a quartet. And
well, that's pretty much it right there.
Right there?
Yeah, we're going to go up the mountain here after the
fall. Yeah, we'll go up the mountain together.
Great. Well, a couple of years ago, I was having this same conversation with the Takash Quartet, and it happened to be maybe a year or two after Jerry Walther joined them. And I asked, what's it like touring and being together that much? And hanging out. And she said, well, a funny thing is when I joined the quartet, I thought, oh, we'll all go out to eat after the concert and we'll all have long conversations and have lunch together and go to museums together. And she said, these people never socialize. And I'm left alone. So I don't know what...
I think that's it's a sort of a different balance in every quartet. And also, every time when we've had any member change, the whole balance completely changes. Mm. So it's just a very personal thing. I think our quartet, actually, we spend more time together than a lot of quartets do, especially when we're touring during the year. Like, if you have a concert somewhere, oftentimes at least two or three of us will go out to dinner after the concert or go get a drink. That's not uncommon. It's just a balance between having a private life but also I think it's for us, or at least for me, it's important to want to be around people that I'm going to be around that much. Mm-hmm. So I think it's nice to have some kind of social life with the people that you're going to be with that much. If you don't have that, then it's like there's always you have to put a huge wall, like, oh, I don't want to see them outside of rehearsal and we don't get along and all. Sometimes that can be there, and I don't think that that's what I would want if I had a choice.
As someone who's been in the group for literally 1 month, I have an interesting perspective on this. It's really fun for me that, my brother, who's also happens to be, and this is not all the case in all families, is also one of my best friends. So far it's been great, but talk to me in a year and we'll see what happens.
Okay. But for instance, going back to Mozart quartet, and so Pierre and Adam, you have been with this quartet for years and years and years. And
well,
now
Pierre and I definitely have the most familial obviously outside of brothers, but mm-hmm. in terms of quartet dynamics, we've been together for so long that I think we drive each other crazy, but we also, love each other in a way that we kind of have to at this point. But anyway, sorry.
Okay, but when Brendan, when you came in, did you think, well, I have some ideas about this quartet which I would like to express, or did you think, okay, I better just lay low?
I will be 100% honest. So far, I've just laid low.
Said a few things.
So, yeah. Like, Brooke, can you play it a little bit softer? That's about the extent of what I've said so far.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am always fascinated, and there is no rule of how quartets rehearse, what their protocol is, to what degree they say, I hate what you're doing, or I love what you're doing, or could you do this? What is it like?
I mean, honestly, it really does change every day, and I don't mean to escape a real answer there. It really depends on individual moods of every day. I mean, it's not like in other instances where you're at a chamber music festival or during the year and you get together with four other freelance chamber musicians and you have two or three select rehearsals. So you have to, if they're 2 or 3 hours long, you show up and you have to do the work there because that's the time that you have allotted together. You play a concert, you go your separate ways. Everyone's usually pretty friendly for the most part, accommodating. For us, because we see each other and because we play with each other so often, and we've heard criticism from each other in so many ways, and oftentimes we're all used to the same criticisms from one particular person. In a way, those criticisms almost become watered down because we've heard them so many times.
It's like a marriage, basically.
It really is. So some days, I think one person can come in and that person could really just kind of be tired and not in a good mood, and they might be silent and just sort of... they just want to play, and you have some thoughts, okay, I'll do that. And then the next day, that same person come in really having a lot of excitement and say, no, I really want to do this, I want to do this, I want to do this. And that role has been occupied by all four of us at any given time.
I just remember when we first formed as a quartet, and we would go in and play for David Sawyer, and in the beginning he would always say, you guys need to be more honest with each other in rehearsal. Like, just don't hold back, because it's not good, basically. And then a few years later, I remember we came in and played for him, and he was like, you guys should be nicer to each other. So that's a pretty good summary right there. It's somewhere between honest and nice.
I don't know if you guys have seen the iFidelity movie about the Guarneri Quartet, because Michael Tree puts it in a way that I think it's right on the money. He says, we all feel persecuted at time when you're playing the quartet, but that feeling moves from one another like a melody would in a quartet. And I think that's putting it just right. I mean, I think at times we all felt like we've been picked on, even though like we try to do our best every time. But like, you know, we have to remember that even though sometimes it's difficult to take criticism. But one thing that I must say that we do well in our quartet so far is we try to keep it only about the music. It never becomes something personal. If it would become a personal issue, and I can talk about that because my wife right now used to be the original second violinist up until 2012. And her name's Wuji, and you know, she was studying in Manhattan School with Pinky Zuckerman, just like Adam at the beginning. And I remember I asked my colleagues at one point, like, do you feel that it causes you any problem that we're married? And they said, no, it's fine, because actually we happen to disagree. Even it's not like we were there and like vetoed everything, because we were kind of a coalition of some sort, because we had like 50% of the vote. No, actually we tended to happen to disagree on everything pretty much. It was not a problem.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Okay, how about repertoire choice? Does it ever happen that someone says, I want to play Elliot Carter, and everyone else says, shut up?
Well, not really. I think we're usually pretty okay. I think if one person really, really doesn't want to play something, we probably wouldn't force it down their you know, there's so much music for a string quartet. I don't think that anyone needs to. On the other hand, like, we could probably play something for one season too and also not suffer that much. So I think we're all pretty reasonable about that.
My wife plays in a different string quartet, and they have a rule every year when it comes to selecting repertoire, which is, well, in general, two of the members sort of take the time to work out the general programs for that year. If all four people try and take an even hand, you'll just end up wasting so much time trying to figure out what to play. It's actually better to divvy up the responsibility. But they all four members get one piece that cannot be vetoed. Huh. And they get one of those a year. Hmm. And they have to do it. And so we don't do that, because I don't think anybody, or if we have, I don't think there's been an instance where one person has demanded to play a certain piece and it's met much resistance. But
I don't know. I think it's good for someone to play something even if they don't like it. I think it's good. I'm even though I've heard like people
saying, "Hey, Pierre,
sing,
we're gonna have to play those Carter quartets soon."
That's fine, actually. But I think there's something good about that. Doing something that you at first was not appealing to you. I don't know. I don't abide necessarily, but those rules, like someone says, I don't want to do it. I'm trying to be flexible personally. If someone was really like against playing a piece, I might like, that's fine. But
well, we have a few minutes if you have questions or comments from the audience. And if you do, please wait just a second and we'll have a mic brought down to you.
I'm curious about what would cause a composer to compose for a string quartet, take on that challenge. And I'm wondering, you've been talking about some of the great string quartets. Are there some composers that have been less successful with this form, maybe more successful with symphonies or concertos and things like that, and less successful with the string quartet?
Well, I think composers generally have thought of, or especially at this point, think of quartet writing as one of the, you know, really one of the high ground, one of the things that they're going to really express themselves in. And that's probably just because it sort of started out that way. I think the two forms that composers express their sort of innermost thoughts were piano sonatas and string quartets historically. And so that tradition is sort of continued. I mean, Brahms famously wrote, I don't remember how many, but like 8 quartets and burned them all before he was willing to publish one, because he was living in the shadow. He felt there was a shadow of Beethoven. So I think composers still feel that same amount of pressure. And you can see how few quartets composers wrote in the 20th century compared to before that. Almost every composer wrote 1 or 2 quartets, or very, very many composers of the great composers only wrote 1 quartet, only felt that they were able to achieve that, probably. So I don't know.
There's probably something to be said about the fact that the string quartet was, especially during Beethoven and Brahms' time, less public. So I think that you could feel a little more free to express your innermost thoughts. And actually, in the 20th century, I think that expressed itself in a really interesting way, which was with Shostakovich in Soviet Russia. A lot of his symphonies sort of pay homage, whether or not he liked it, to the Soviet administration. Lots of sort of heroic people kind of music. And in his string quartets, there's a lot of political dissonance in them. So that's another interesting way of looking at it, I think.
So I will give a quick composer's answer, and it has something that may be horrifying to you guys. My principal teacher, Roger Sessions, I came in one time with a string trio that I had started working on, and he said, that is an extremely bad idea. A string quartet should be a composition in 3 voices for 4 instruments, and so you should take the string trio and make it into a quartet. And so then we were talking about that, and he said, you know, you should study the quartets of Mendelssohn because they are very overwritten. Their textures are way too thick, and you should really confront that. And then when Mendelssohn goes to the octet, all of a sudden, it's a fabulous texture because it's fewer parts. The number of voices to people playing ratio is suddenly very different.
I guess that's one way to look at it. I have no real response.
Even Beethoven struggled to write quartets. I think there's a letter he wrote to one of his friends. I finally, when he was like 30 years old or so, I finally understood how to write quartets. But it was in the handling of the middle voice for him. If you look at the manuscript, it's how like the... because you need... what's hard about writing a string quartet, I wrote one, is to preserve the integrity of the line. That says that you need to give something substantial or interesting at least. So in a way, it's you go back to the very beginning of music, like when you have like 2 lines together, counterpoint. But even though you need to have also some sort of harmony, and I think the composers from the classical period, like Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, and they invented that form, and they did something extraordinary with it at that time. But like to come up with something that equals that, you either have to go in a completely different direction, or you just won't do it. It's very difficult, because it's, to me, it's impossible to achieve what they have done in that genre.
So any other question, comment? Then I think we will say thank you to the Escher Quartet, and they are Saturday at 8 p.m.
Thank you. Thank you.